For the third year in a row, John McEnroe Jr. is the United States Open champion and leaves little doubt about who's number one.
The runner-up, Bjorn Borg, is truly a great champion and a great credit to the game of tennis. We are sorry he is unable to be here to receive the runner-up award, which...
Joining the commiseration for Bjorn, because I think he is a great champion. And sooner or later, I think he's going to win this damn tournament, but hopefully not as long as I'm around.
So that was Bjorn Rune Borg leaving the stadium, Flushing Meadow, not showing up to the presentation, one of the key moments, perhaps in tennis history.
It is. You think that Borg was 25 years old at the time, number two in the world, holder of the French title, basically walked out of the stadium and out of tennis.
And it was his fourth loss at the US Open, which he was never to win.
Never to win, and his fourth consecutive loss to McEnroe.
Now, this podcast, we're talking about this incredible moment where McEnroe was left on the podium on his own. Borg doesn't show up to do his speech. He grabs his bag, heads out the stadium to a waiting car. Question I have for you, do you think he had someone there in the car during the match, gunning it, waiting for him?
Well, if he did, what would have happened if Borg had won that match? You'd have some poor sap sitting in a car just waiting for Borg, who would never arrive. I mean, had he thought of that? Was there a plan B?
I have no idea. And his petrol runs out. He's sitting there. Borg's living the high life in New York City, the toast of the town.
Whooping it up. This poor guy's there at midnight still waiting for Borg while Borg's there hitting the high spots, Studio 54.
And this guy's checking his watch thinking, wow, this game must be going into overtime.
Look, I don't know about that, but I love thinking about that moment when Borg is just walking through that tunnel. What is going through his mind as he's walking through that tunnel?
Okay, we know rumours. There were death threats.
Yes.
The day before, I think there was. Was that the motivation? I don't know. Why wouldn't he have come back if there were just death threats that day? And who gave the death threats? Was it Mary Carrillo?
Mary loved Bjorn, so I think you have to absolve her from any suspicion there. Buzz.
Of course, the great Mary Carrillo. How dare I?
Yes.
Besmirch her name.
That's right.
Yes.
I've heard reports, and there are a couple of attendants in the tunnel when Borg was making his way out, and they're saying that Borg was smiling. He was smiling and singing to himself as he was walking out there. So was this possibly the happiest day of Borg's life?
He's out there singing a little Swedish ditty.
Oh, I think he would have been singing Borg free, as free as... But you get what I'm saying. Oh, Borg
absolutely
is a free man now.
So we've got this impression of Borg with a weight on his shoulders walking through that tunnel.
It's been lifted.
Maybe it was a culmination, perhaps.
He's thinking, finally, I'm free now to spend the rest of my days doing what I love, reading comic books, tickling Leonard Berglund under the chin. I mean, they were his two main hobbies at the time.
He could just spend his life borging around.
So maybe he was happy. Maybe he wasn't depressed and sad. Maybe he finally found freedom.
Maybe he accepted the fact that he'd never win the US Open. Now, we've got to remember that Borg didn't hold the US Open as highly, anywhere near as high as he held Wimbledon.
Yeah, it's only because he didn't win it.
McEnroe wins in four sets. This was a relatively easy victory against Borg because they had some incredible matches, which we'll be talking about in a sec. One of the greatest rivalries in tennis history, perhaps the most famous in some ways, that's only been taken over maybe in recent years by Nadal Djokovic. But before those guys, this was the greatest rivalry in tennis, perhaps later Roseball. Okay, I'm undermining my own thesis here by mentioning other people.
Yes.
Navratilova, Evert.
Marks and Pfister. But yes, it was a rivalry that captured the imagination of the world. And we didn't know it at the time that it had ended there.
No, of course not.
Mm.
And Johnny Mack, the great John McEnroe, who had got the better of Borg in the last year or so.
Yes.
He was devastated that Borg had left tennis. Borg was his hero, which is another issue we'll be talking about in this podcast. So he looked up to Borg in a way that was very unusual for competitors at the same time, for peers.
Yes.
Very unusual. It's particularly someone you're getting the better of. Like we know, for example, in boxing, when Muhammad Ali beat George Foreman became like an acolyte of Ali, loved the guy because he'd been beaten by him. But McEnroe was beating Borg, and yet he still held him in that kind of veneration.
Is there some weird connection to Stockholm syndrome?
Well, he's Swedish.
Is that the right term, where you fall in love with the person who captures
you?
Yeah,
that's Stockholm syndrome. It was invented by Bjorn Borg.
It was?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. What hope did McEnroe have?
It was so shocking when he stopped. So surprising. Not really someone that I could test myself or look at and say, okay, what do I need to do now? Not that there weren't other players there, but I kept waiting for him to come back. And so it took me a while, a year or two, to realize he wasn't coming back.
Here's a question for you, Remo. Just off the bat, without notice.
Mm-hmm.
Bjorn Borg recently has said that he looks at his younger self, that man who was winning all those Wimbledons and French Opens, and he doesn't relate to him. He doesn't know who that guy is anymore. And I'm wondering if he's basically giving the game away. Do you think Borg was replaced?
A cyborg. Is this what angle are you taking here?
I'm not sure.
Okay, because I think my theory is he was well and truly burnt out. He'd had enough.
Yeah.
Now, some unkind people were saying, well, he bailed because McEnroe was getting the better of him and he couldn't stand the thought of not being number one and not being able to get over the top of McEnroe. I'm not sure about that, but I do know that he did say to John McEnroe, when you're number two or three, you might as well be nobody. Now, that's a quote from Borg, and he was number two. I think McEnroe referred to him as nobody from that point on.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because there's another quote from Borg where they put this theory to him that he retired because John McEnroe was beating him.
Hmm.
And he rejects it outright. He says, I was never that kind of guy. That's not why I left. He has said he would love to know why he was so ambitious about tennis to begin with. He fell in love with the game from the first time he hit a ball. He was quite young. I don't know if he was 10 or 9 or 10, maybe a little bit younger. Then he said he'd love someone to explain why he lost his motivation, because he lost it totally.
Well,
and he knew it.
Well, if I was in the room at the time, I could have explained it to Bjorn, and I'll explain it now if you like.
Please.
Okay, it's a two-part theory.
Give me part one to start with.
Stay with me on this. When a tennis player arrives on the scene, they pretty much come with the house that they've built. They've built their game up, they've got their style, they've got their strokes. I'm calling it's the house that they've built, in which they present their game. Bjorn Borg built a specific type of house. He had a specific type of game. And I'm just going to read a couple of excerpts from a book by Richard Evans called Open Tennis, The First 20 Years. To set the scene, Borg's farewell appearance was in Monte Carlo in 1982. Would have been 5 or 6 months, I think, after the end of the US Open or thereabouts. He was beaten by LeConte in the second round, and that was pretty much it. Monte Carlo was merely the epilogue, Evans writes. I had seen the final chapter being written some months before in Geneva. It was clear that back then it was evident that Borg was becoming bored, not so much with being Borg, but with having to play like him. Now, Evans is referring to a match that Borg was playing against Manolo Arantes, the great Spaniard clay courter of the day. Now, Borg won the first set easily. Through the course of the match, Arantes was injured. He could see he was injured, immobilised, he couldn't move. So for the second set, Borg decided to play serve, exclusively serve and volley. Now, Arantes was able to win that second set 6-1. He was a canny player. Somebody coming to the net on slow clay was no match for Arantes, and he beat Borg in the second set 6-1. Arantes wins that second set, and then Borg, square shoulders rolled, a little more wearily as he strode back to the baseline, was a prisoner returning to his cell. He never spelled it out in so many words afterwards, but I've always felt that we'd just witnessed the moment that terminated Borg's career. He went back and won the third set, playing from the baseline. Now, that's an observation from Richard Evans, essentially saying that Borg was trapped in a game style outside of those 2 weeks in Wimbledon on grass, where for him to win, he was playing from the baseline. Borg never really modified his game, except for when he changed surfaces. This yeah. house analogy, look, a player might redecorate a room, might put some extra padding in somewhere where they need to address parts of their game. But essentially, the house they built is the house that they will stay in.
Maybe it's worth remembering also that Borg, before Nadal, was the greatest clay court player who ever lived.
Yes.
But you have to say it was the most boring game of all time, and it was just attrition. Not the same on grass. He played a much more vibrant game on grass.
Totally different.
But on clay, and you've talked about watching the Borg-Lendl French Open final.
One of the most turgid tennis matches I've ever witnessed. I bought a copy of the DVD years ago. It actually came with a breathing mask and a tube of oxygen. It was the only way you could get through it.
And that's only a match where Lendl, during points, had tears streaming down his face, thinking, save me from this, because he couldn't stand it anymore. But if Borg felt caught within that, you'd understand it. I mean, people said he threw himself into every shot like it was his last.
Mm. And there was no other way for him to play on clay should there be, in that this was his game and this was what he was excellent at. But if it was boring him out of his mind.
He was a prisoner in some ways of the wooden racket. Mm. A small-headed wooden racket where you're playing topspin, that is a difficult gig. I don't care what anyone says.
Mm.
That is not easy. You can look at it and go, it's boring and this and that, but to keep that up hour after hour, I mean, that takes a certain kind of mental precision that, well, I don't have it.
Well, not many do, but just on the second part of this theory, yes. Borg being burnt out, and a lot of this gets swept under the carpet, but Borg chased the money god very, very hard.
He did.
In terms of his exhibitions, some of the schedules that he was working towards to meet various commitments to these exhibition matches, that was ludicrous, the sort of scheduling that he was putting himself under. If the money was good, he wouldn't say no. Borg was, in fact, tennis's first great exhibitionist, I would say. Yeah, and I think it would have been okay if Borg had left it to tennis. But this whole thing just started expanding into all sorts of crazy areas. Like, the Italians would fill out an auditorium just to watch Borg eat a bowl of pasta fasool. He was doing that. In Norway, they would watch him sleeping, tossing and turning, snoring like a foghorn, and they would pay money for that.
And Borg would run to the airport afterwards. He'd have his keep. He'd run to the airport from Norway to Rome to Oslo. Like, it was ridiculous.
It was. He was doing all sorts of things, and I think it all came to a head where the Federation had to step in with some of those early rounds of the French Open. He started charging the ball girls and ball boys for the privilege of handing him balls during a match.
Interesting you say that.
Well, he'd be there with his money belt, dispensing change. Financial transactions were going on. It was just ridiculous. I mean, it just got too much.
Well, this segues into something else. You're talking about ball girls, ball boys. Early in the 70s, who was a ball boy for Bjorn Borg?
John McEnroe.
Saw this guy, basically fell in love with him. One of the strangest stories in tennis history. When I say fell in love with him, I don't mean in a romantic sense, but saw this guy who looked like a Swedish god, a Viking.
Now, this was before Borg was charging ball boys and ball girls? Okay. So McEnroe, there was nothing going on.
Nothing happening there.
Okay.
I don't think McEnroe would have stood for that. That's for a later time. I think what we're talking about here is, why did Bjorn Borg lose his ambition? And why did he lose his focus? Well, something that's never quite brought up is the fact that he won the 1980 Wimbledon against McEnroe in that very famous match. I mean, one of the most famous matches in tennis history. Played superbly in that fifth set. He got married soon after to Mariana, his fiancée. And then he went on a losing streak. He never won anything else other than the French. My question is, did he just wake up one morning and think, is this the life of Bjorn Borg? Is this the life I've dreamt for myself? And maybe that was the prison as well. He's playing Orantes in the finals, who is arguably the best clay court player in the world, very experienced. Well, Orantes is up 2-0. Orantes not only lost to Borg, in five sets, he lost 6-0, 6-1, and 6-1. And Borg didn't have to wait until the next year for people to say he was a great player. That was his coming out party.
Borg serves for the championship. Bjorn Borg's the winner, and his racket goes sky high. At
20, Borg isn't the youngest champion ever, but you'd have to go back 45 years to find a younger one. Yet he is the first Swede to win at Wimbledon. Congratulations to a brilliant young Viking.
C'est fini! Une démonstration de tennis de Björn Borg qui s'impose 6-1, 6-1, 6-3 face à Guillermo Vilas.
The calmest man in the place.
The 1980 men's singles final was an amazing spectacle, which concluded with Bjorn Borg underlining his greatness by securing his fifth consecutive Wimbledon crown, to leave John McEnroe in the depths of despair.
What Borg did is really what ushered in this modern way of thinking about records.
Yes.
Now, we know they've always existed, and you can go back years and years and see some amazing stats of, I know the times were different with players winning five, six, seven times in a row, but it had all gotten forgotten, really, until Borg started winning things in a row and building these records, and all of a sudden, it became something again.
That's right, and let's not forget, for 3 years in a row, he won the French Wimbledon double, which...
Yes, never been done.
Incredible record that the man had. And yet, he loses four US Open finals, as we heard at the beginning of the podcast.
Mm.
That's not his greatest regret. His greatest regret is losing the 1981 Wimbledon final to McEnroe, which he lost in four sets. He said, I lost it and I didn't care. And he said, that wasn't me. I don't know what had happened. And I think that led him then, a couple months later, to this US Open final where he left the building. So I think that was a big lead into that.
Yes, he wasn't enjoying being Bjorn Borg anymore.
No, he tried to change his name.
He did. But what was he trying to change it to?
Lester Craggs. He tried to change it to Lester Craggs. They wouldn't have a bar of it down there.
No, I think there was one week where there was a Lester Craggs ranked number 3 in the world early in 1982, but it was quickly withdrawn. So yeah. The paperwork obviously snuck through and then got pulled back out. I remember McEnroe seeing the draw and saying, beautiful, I'm playing Lester Craggs. Who is this bum?
And then Bjorn Borg rolls up, he goes, wow, okay. That escalated quickly.
Sure did.
Now, Bjorn Borg leaves the stadium a year later. As you said, he's out of the game.
Yes.
John McEnroe is devastated. He said Borg was lifting his game. He thought they were playing tennis at the highest level it had ever been played. And when Borg left, he was depressed. And his results show it for the next year. In 82, they weren't great.
Mm. He felt cheated.
Mm.
And Buzz... I know that you've expressed at the time that you felt empty.
Bjorn Borg was my childhood sporting hero, and he retired at 25 or 26, whatever it was.
Who decides when the hero departs the stage? Is it the hero? It should be the hero, but often, more often than not, the adulators won't let them go.
No, the thing was, I retired when I was like 26 years old, and... It came to a point that I did not enjoy playing tennis anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't have the motivation. And,
right.
I wanted to try other things in life, experience other things in life. Then people come back and they say, why did you stop playing tennis?
Right.
And for me, thinking, going back for so many years, If I had the kind of a protection with teams and people around you, like the players has today,
right.
Maybe I should been playing many more years.
Sure.
I don't know, but during that time, it was very difficult because I was well recognized all over the world.
Mm-hmm,
and sometimes you want to be private or have your privacy with the family or a wife, kids.
Yeah.
But it was very difficult for me to have that. And maybe that was one of the reasons.
Well, being joined now by Teddy Shingles. Teddy, thank you for coming in. Of course, Teddy needs no introduction. Most people know that, of course, Bjorn Borg married, was it a childhood sweetheart, Mariana Simonescu?
No, there wasn't a childhood sweetheart. I think they met in 1976 or so. So Borg was about 20-odd.
Okay, beg your pardon.
Mariana was a lovely woman. We're friends to this day.
Mm-hmm.
in her house. She lives with her mother, and she's never remarried. Never remarried. And she has around her house photos of the prime time that they had together between 76 and 82. Photos all over the house, and she has said, "Bjorn was the love of my life, but I was not the love of Bjorn's."
That's very sad.
I cried. I was crying. I was crying anyway. I cry a lot around Mariana. But she's a lovely woman. I won't say a word against her. Absolutely warm-hearted woman. And it always piques my interest to see her in that 1980 Wimbledon when you see her in the box.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I remember those days with Bjorn and Mariana like they were yesterday. Mariana was essential to his peace of mind. And I don't think people understand that. She would take his moods and iron them out. But did he love her? Did he love her? I know she loved him.
Was it a time when Bjorn was capable of loving a woman during those five Wimbledons and six French Opens? And of course, there were the superstitions. He was extremely superstitious, Teddy.
He would have to wear the same clothing. He would have to park in the same car park. He'd have to eat the same meal. He'd have to insult the same waiters. And he'd have to goose the same worker at the elevator. What are they called? They don't have them anymore.
An attendant.
The attendant, yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
On the same floor, too.
You talk about the parking in the same spot. Now, what happened on the day, and you weren't to know, but you parked your little Morris Minor in Bjorn's spot. Do you remember what happened?
I'll never forget it. It was one of the darkest days of my life. Suddenly Bjorn, who was always very jovial, he was always reserved or jovial with me, one of the two, never anything in between. But I got the full force of his Swedish Viking persona that day. He tore into the room and said, Teddy. I said, "Bjorn, what is it? Have I done something, Bjorn? I'd never seen him look like this, and I was terrified. I wondered how anyone else could have borne the brunt of such ill humour."
And there was Leonard Berglund in the corner just looking askance at you, saying, "There's nothing I can do."
Have you seen footage of Berglund when Borg wins Wimbledon and he's standing like Dr. Frankenstein with his arms in the air? He was standing exactly the same in the corner. I thought to myself...
What kind of egging Bjorn on?
There's Berglund in the corner with his arms up like Dr. Frankenstein. There's Borg like an angry Viking. Mariana out on the patio...
Smoking
two cigarettes at a time. It was one of the greatest absurd moments of my life. Anyway, I said to Bjorn, "What? Have it out with me, Bjorn. We're good enough friends for this." And he just looked at me and he made a sign. I don't know if you know the badge of a Morris Minor, but it's... He made the sign with his fingers. And I thought, "Well, what's he doing now? The crazy Swede." And all he said to me was, "Teddy, move it." So I started to dance. So let me set the scene for you. Once again, Leonard Berglund in the corner, like Dr. Frankenstein, an angry Bjorn Borg, and there I am dancing.
And did that calm Bjorn down?
Well, that actually proved to be quite a circuit breaker.
Right.
He joined me momentarily.
Well, he loves to dance.
He loves to do a Swedish jig, does Bjorn.
Oh, so you smoothed it over through dancing, basically.
Absolutely. And people have asked me, "Well, you're very good friends with Mariana now. What is your relationship with Bjorn?" Well, I say, we don't see each other often anymore. The time has gone by and we've grown apart. But I love the man, and I think he loves me. Now, there's a bond we share that no amount of massages can remove from my musculature.
Teddy, on such a lovely, tender moment, we might just end it there.
Thank you, Remo, and God bless you. Here's something to think about. Roger Federer was recently asked who in history he would like to play. And most people assumed he would say Rod Laver. And he didn't. He said he would like to play Bjorn Borg at Wimbledon. That was his answer. I think it says volumes.
So really, Federer chickened out there. Instead of playing Borg on clay, he chose to play him on grass. Interesting.
You're calling Federer a chicken. Well, that wraps up... Well, what do you think, Rim? Have we covered this subject? Have we honoured his memory of what a wonderful tennis player he was? Because he was fantastic.
I hope we have. Look, have we cut to the nub of what happened on that day in 1981? Possibly not, but how do you?
Only two people know, and that's Bjorn Borg and Lester Craigs.
That's right. And some people have seen them together. Some people say they're never in the same room. We don't know.
And that's just another mystery.
Another mystery may be worthy of its own podcast.
Perhaps. So stay tuned.
Sure. Are you sure that Roger Federer didn't say that he wanted to play Lester if he could pick any player?
Lester Craigs versus Roger Federer. Now, there's a match for the ages.
Oh, I'd pay good money to see that.